Good afternoon. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, live on the web, on Saturday, August the... Forgive me, I'm lost in time. But this is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review, speaking to you from The LaRouche Show. Our guests this afternoon are going to be two international heroines, Amelia Boynton Robinson. Amelia is a founder of the U.S. civil rights movement going back to the 1920s, the 1930s, and she is a official with the Lyndon LaRouche Movement's Schiller Institute. She has just been to Iran and throughout Europe, an ambassador of peace. And also with her is Muriel Mirach-Weisbach, one of the founders of Executive Intelligence Review and a member of the editorial board. Last week, we had as our guest Lyndon LaRouche, presidential candidate for the Democratic Party nomination and the founder of Executive Intelligence Review. As we speak right now, there have been over 500,000 copies of a leaflet called The Electable LaRouche, part of a 5 million distribution of that leaflet and similar leaflets for the LaRouche campaign that are a strategic flank to stop one of the greatest catastrophes that has ever faced the United States and the world. I'm going to quote from what Mr. LaRouche said last Saturday on The LaRouche Show. At that time, Lynn said, "The point is that we are now headed toward a war, an Iraq war, an expansion of the current war going on in Israel. That's the way it is. It might be extended to Syria. It might involve operations in Lebanon. It might also include even a nuclear missile dropped on a nuclear energy site in Iran or something else. It is intended to go into a full-scale conflict against the Islamic populations of the world, either against them or in stirring up wars in which they fight one another or fight other groups. So this is the thing we have to stop, because this would mean the end of civilization. The clash of civilizations. This is what LaRouche has identified as coming from Zbigniew Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, Bernard Lewis, but the people who are driving this forward at this time are two senators, the Bull Moose duo, Senator John McCain and Senator Joe Lieberman. These two characters in the United States Senate are doing more to drive the United States and the world to war than most people understand. This is what LaRouche is taking on, because these characters, McCain and Lieberman, are also running a dictatorship over the United States Senate to close off all debate and to close off the truth to stop this war. We're going to be discussing this today, the alternative to this global catastrophe is a new financial system, a new Bretton Woods system, and what Lyndon LaRouche, Helga LaRouche, Amelia, and Muriel have been representing as the dialogue of civilizations. We also have with us a live audience in the 85th week of a discussion every Saturday. Citizens from all over the United States and Canada have had a weekly organizers conference call to discuss questions that come up in their political organizing and meetings. And they join the LaRouche Show live every week and then continue their discussions after our webcast is over. A little later, I would like to invite the organizers and listeners on that organizers conference calls to have questions for our guests, Amelia Robinson and Muriel Mirach-Weisbach, on the question of the dialogue of civilizations and stopping this war drive. Let me tell you a little bit about the trip that our colleagues made. Mrs. Robinson was invited to Iran by the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, and in numerous events there, she showed that the power against which African Americans and others in the United States were fighting during the civil rights struggle was the same one that is threatening the world today. As it was reported in our newspaper New Federalist, many Iranian interviewers, as well as the political figures she met, stressed their view that the racist policies against African Americans in 1965 are being repeated today against the new enemy image, Islam. In this, Iran is being targeted specifically as a member of the axis of evil. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'd like to ask Amelia now to tell us, what is Iran like and the peace mission that you discussed with our Iranian friends? Go ahead, Amelia.
I think we have had such a cloudy conception of what Iran is like. People who have read and the things that have been said with reference to making war have an idea that the country is one that is backward, one that is not Christian, one that does not know how to treat its subjects, but it is just as far from the truth as one has ever thought. Because Iran is like New York. Now, a lot of people think that is just saying something, but let me tell you some few things about it. Iran, the capital is Tehran, has 21 airlines and high-rise buildings, residential buildings, are being built by the hundreds. They have 90 hospitals, many parks, and the beautiful thing about it is families are together, something that America doesn't have time because of the fact we have to work, husband and wife both have to work two jobs and maybe three to be able to pay just the ordinary expense of living. There are hotels, they have 15 stadiums, they have theaters, 11 universities. Now this is in Tehran. 11 universities. And the beautiful thing about it is that they believe so strongly in God. They believe that the family means a whole lot when it comes down to living and living morally. We think of the way they dress. I think it's great. If that's their culture, I don't think that we should look upon it as not being like we are, because wherein we are undressing, the women dress. And they are not just women, they are professional. Many of them are professional women. And the divorce rate is 5 out of 10,000. That's of 1996. The women are working, and in the city, 88.79% of the women are working. In the rural district, 35.63. The literacy rate of women have increased 33.6%, and that's in higher education. The women are very intelligent, and they have women in parliament. They have women in women's affairs, and it is fascinating. It's actually superior to what we're doing here. And one thing about Iran, and Tehran, of course, they have enjoyed the bitterness of war. But Through it all, they are now enjoying the sweetness of peace. And unfortunately, America is going after them. And as far as I can see, it is because they're happy and satisfied. And they have, of course, minerals and oil, including oil. And we're going after them. Why don't we go after Great Britain? And they're not terrorists. They don't believe in terrorists. They are a spiritual country with 300 mosques or more. Their achievements in culture are social and politically and economically rising, very much on the rise. And when I went there, and of course, my invitation was one that I didn't expect. And I guess the way I felt at the beginning was that the country was one that was not on the upward trend in culture, but I found that they can give culture to America. When I went there, I was invited by the Iran Broadcasting Company. And I was interviewed by many, many of the Iranian television and other news media on different programs. One day we had 6 interviews. Other days we had 2, 3, and 4. And these included 2 popular talk shows as well as national radio. It's hard. It's hard to get people to visualize this country being like much more forward when it comes down to culture than the United States is. And Iran leads it all. And it's hard for a person to visualize when in history we've talked about the illiteracy, we talked about the immorality, we talked about everything except what Iran and Tehran are. But they are a typical example of what America should be, a typical example for the whole world. And I am just so pleased that I happen to be one to be invited, because my objective was to let them know that having worked for 35 years before Dr. King came into Selma, that what we were doing, I have always felt that I cannot go back, but everything we did to lift the standard of at that time, African Americans who lived under the slave rules, and having fought to get them from under that type of living, Dr. King coming in 35 years after we had worked to bring these people from under the subjects of slavery, that it was something that I felt proud of. And very, very wisely, Dr. King came in and worked with us in 1965, with me, because of the pressure that my husband endured with the attempt to beat him, with the economic pressure that was that we had to endure. And in spite of it all, my husband nor I gave up. And that was one thing that I still say to Iran and to other countries, don't give up.
Amelia, it's always wonderful to speak to you. I don't know where to begin. You mentioned the fight that you and your husband had for voting rights, for civil rights. I also want to remind people that you are the recipient of many civil rights awards and the famous photograph of you having been gassed and beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Can you tell us about the just a little bit about that work with Dr. King that you did?
After Dr. King became a public figure, and that was after Rosa Parks sat on the bus and would not get out, and we invited him to come to Selma. Well, he didn't get there until after the death of my husband, as I said. His death was because of the pressure, economic and physical pressure. When Dr. King came in, the people were afraid of him because the system said, and personally I received a call, but they were told that Dr. King was a rabble-rouser and he was a communist. And everybody was afraid of communism, though they didn't know what it was all about. They just were afraid of the word because the objective was of the system was to make people afraid to communicate with him. Consequently, when he came in, he came to the office, and he said, I would like to go to the cafes. Everything was segregated at that time. And I said, all right, I'll take you to one of the most humble parts of Selma. And when he drank a cup of coffee and started out, what we used to say the have-nots, people who were perhaps retired or on welfare or whatnot, they were the ones who moved with him. Left that cafe, and each time we would go to a cafe, there would be people, humble people, who had no jobs, and they would go with you. Nobody said to Dr. King, will you accept coming to my house, or would you like to have a drink of water, or we are happy to see you here. No, they were afraid. And when I said they were afraid, I'm speaking about the intelligentsias, not the have-nots. People who had offices on the street where my office was never said a word. And nobody offered him a seat. So I told him, you and your staff can have half of my office, which is across from the city hall, and I'll turn my house over to you. And when you come in, I invite you to just come here because this will be your home. And, of course, the dignitaries who came into Selma, that was the only place they had to go. And that is why we had so many people of note, so many people, black and white, who were in sympathy with what we went through. And that was the only place. And to think, I'd like to tell you the story of what happened when my husband died. Dr. King had sent somebody in, a young man by the name of Bernard Lafayette. And when my husband died, he asked a minister of one of the outstanding churches to let him have a memorial there. And the minister said, why, yes. But when he approached the deacons, they said, oh, no, you don't. You don't have any memorial here for that man, and you know that white folks don't like him. Now, that was what most of them would say, what white people don't like. And he said, well, if I can't have it here in the church, I'll have it in the street, in front of the church. And, of course, I think they became ashamed and said, okay, you can have it here. In the meantime, Jim Clark, the man who controlled the whole county and who was vicious, he was criminally vicious, and he called all full-blooded white men to come into my office and be sworn in and given ammunition. So when these people came to the church, they had to come through a line of deputized sheriffs. And that was on Friday night. On Monday morning, when they went to their jobs at the lumber yards, at the factories, at the industries, and even in the homes, they were told, you don't have any job. You're fired because you attended that meeting Friday night, that meeting of the Boynton's. And of course, it was the first time that it struck a nerve with these adults, because their children were out there demonstrating, trying to get their parents to realize that they were not first-class citizens until they became a registered voter, and they were demonstrating for their parents. Now, when the parents found out that they were slaves and they couldn't even go to their church on Friday nights, they said, I'm getting in that line, and I'm going to march, and I'm going to demonstrate, too. And that was where they had a rude awakening. And, of course, we had people coming in, black people, white people, red, brown, and yellow. All of them came in to help us. And this is one of the things that awakened them. And I think even now, what has happened with the Voting Rights Act, that people died for, black and white, that we need to get out there again and begin to realize that we don't have it made. And so many people don't believe that the Voting Rights Act is null and void. And I guess they did not know because it's not publicized. But what we did 35 years before Dr. King, we feel as though that was a landmark. When Dr. King came in and we got the Voting Rights Act, that was a landmark. But to say that we have it made because we can register and vote, no, no. Because here is Lyndon LaRouche, who ran for president, and the news media. And just like they said that Dr. King was a rabble-rouser and a communist, they have done everything to stigmatize him. But he has gone on, picked up the broken pieces of what we did, what Dr. King did, and he took it to the court because they did not want to give him the honor of being one of the candidates. And when he did that, the lower court said that we don't respect and we don't regard the Voting Rights Act because it is null and void.
Amelia, if I can ask a question at this point, because you are reminding me that Mr. LaRouche did win a significant number of delegates in Michigan in 2000, 35 years after the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
And you had to go to the caucus there, because Al Gore and the Democratic Party with Senator Lieberman stole those votes, and you were even roughed up at that time, right?
Yes, that's right.
So the fight absolutely continues, as you're saying.
Yes, and when they stole the votes, that is the reason why they found out that through what Lyndon LaRouche did, that's when they found out that the court said that the Voting Rights Act is no good. He took it on to the United States Supreme Court, which is the law of the land. And they said that the Voting Rights Act is no good, and the Democratic Party is a private party. They can accept or reject whom they wish.
This time, I think Lyndon LaRouche has hit the nail on the head with a campaign to expose Joe Lieberman as not only part of that conspiracy, but also part of the war drive against Iraq. And I'm going to ask Muriel to comment now, because Muriel, you wrote some analysis for the EIR in which you said if Iraq is the number one target for a war by the U.S. warmongers and utopians, then Iran is number two. Can you comment on this?
Yes. I think, unfortunately, that's true. And, of course, we've had indications since President Bush's famous State of the Union address, in which he lumped together North Korea, Iran, and Iraq as members of the Axis of Evil, that indeed Iran is on their hit list. And, of course, recently people who have followed developments know that President Bush has intervened, calling basically on people in the streets in Iran to rise up against their elected government, the government of President Khatami, on grounds that this government is not pushing through the reforms in the way in which people in the United States would like to see done. So Iran is very much targeted, and I think to understand the way in which it's targeted, you have to think of the military situation in the region. We have right now, as Mr. LaRouche said last week on this broadcast, a drive towards war in the region being led by Ariel Sharon in Israel, a war against the Palestinians, against potentially Syria, Lebanon, and many other countries. In the context of a U.S. strike against Iraq, which is being prepared now militarily and logistically and politically, it's assumed and actually being discussed in the region, it's assumed that once the U.S. were to attack Iraq, Sharon would take the opportunity to attack Iran. And the priority target in Iran is the Bushehr nuclear plant. This is a nuclear plant that had been begun before the Iranian Revolution of 1979, was halted then, and has since been in the process of being completed by the Iranians with the help of the Russians. The Israelis have said that they consider this nuclear capability, this is nuclear energy capability, not a bomb, but they consider this a danger and a threat to their security, and therefore they have voiced their willingness to eliminate that particular plant, the way they eliminated a similar plant in Iraq in 1981. And just to emphasize the fact that this is not some abstract idea, but something that's being discussed and prepared for very deliberately, I just want to mention an article that appeared in a leading Israeli newspaper called Haaretz, I think yesterday, in which the senior security and military correspondent reported on the fact that the Israelis are currently involved in a battle exercise with the United States, whereby they, the Israelis, are moving six big F-15 aircraft from the coast on the Mediterranean Sea to the U.S. Now, in order to do that means they have the capability of flying 6,000 kilometers or more, which would be the distance that they would have to fly in order to attack Iran, because they would go around the Arabian Peninsula to attack from the Gulf. Now, the fact that this is being discussed openly in the Israeli press shows that, as I said, these are plans on the drawing board, but there are also plans that are being implemented in live maneuvers. So the danger is very great. People in Iran are aware of this, and you can see this in the very, very active diplomatic activity undertaken by the Iranian government to forge alliances with regional partners, and particularly to denounce the U.S. plans against Iraq, and to express solidarity with all the nations in the region against this kind of attack. The most recent development in this context is the news I just heard here on TV that the Iranian president and the king of Saudi Arabia apparently issued a call warning against any U.S. attack on Iraq. because it should be clear, an attack on Iraq would unleash a process of regional war of the type I described, right? The Israelis would expel the Palestinians into Jordan. They would also attack Lebanon and Syria, and they would take the opportunity to eliminate the Iranian nuclear plant. This would unleash religious warfare throughout the Islamic world. From Morocco across the North African coast, it would destabilize the Egyptian government, the Jordanian and other moderate Arabian governments, Arab governments, and could spread like wildfire throughout West Asia into Southeast Asia, across the Eurasian continent. So, as Mr. LaRouche has said many times, if you start this kind of a war, a religious war, you cannot stop it. You can't win it militarily, and you can't stop it. So the most important thing to do now is to intervene to prevent it, which I think is what the LaRouche movement is doing with the mobilization that you mentioned earlier, Michelle, the mobilization to shake up the current combination of political control in Washington in order to change their policy agenda. I just want to mention in this context, if I may, that LaRouche's views on the war danger, the reasons for it, and the alternative are being debated very, very actively in the Arab and Islamic world. His name has become a household word through the massive press coverage, TV, radio, and other that he's received, particularly since September 11th, throughout the Arab and Islamic world. And he was recently invited to speak, actually to be the keynote speaker at an international conference held in Abu Dhabi, that's the capital of the United Arab Emirates, at the Zayed Center for Coordination and Follow-Up. This is a study center, which is an organ of the Arab League. Mr. LaRouche was invited to speak there June 4th to give a keynote at a conference dealing with the strategic implications of oil and gas policy. And he laid out the strategic picture, including the war danger, and outlined also an approach for overcoming the crisis by solving the problem that is at the source, and that is the financial monetary breakdown crisis through a reform of the monetary system, and also launching infrastructure projects in order to revive the world economy. So his presentation there was just a high point in a process of debate among the intelligentsia in the Arab and Islamic world, where he is becoming more and more identified correctly as the spokesman for the real America. There was one major interview, I think, in an Egyptian newspaper with LaRouche, which was entitled A President of a Different Kind, in which they stressed the fact that LaRouche is not like the others who are lining up for the presidential nomination, but is a political figure, an economist, and a thinker, a philosopher, of a totally different character and quality. And I think this is crucial, because to have that kind of recognition and support among the leading nations in the region, which is right now targeted for an explosion, is crucial in mobilizing the support among other nations to change policy in Washington and in order to avert this war danger.
Muriel, let me tell people how to get in touch with us. And right after this next question, I'd like to ask our organizers on the organizer conference call line to have your questions ready, because we will go right to you. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, the live weekly webcast that you can reach on www.larouchepub.com. Muriel Mirak-Weisbach, a member of the editorial board of the Executive Intelligence Review, and Amelia Boynton Robinson, a leader of the LaRouche movement and a leader of the United States Civil Rights Movement for over 50 years, they're my guests today. If you go to the website www.larouchepub.com, you will find links to the international sites of the LaRouche movement, including in Arabic, in French, in German, in several other languages. Muriel has just told us that Lyndon LaRouche has become a household word throughout the Arab world. I'm happy to say that the article Muriel mentioned, Lyndon LaRouche, a different kind of president, has also been republished in U.S. Arabic language newspapers. If you call, when we're off the air, if you call 1-888-347-3258, you can get more information about the Executive Intelligence Review writings by Amelia Robinson and Muriel, and also about these Arabic publications. Here's a question that we have right now. It came in last week, but we didn't get a chance to get to it by email, and it's very, very pertinent to what you just said. This caller, Stephen from the state of New York, said, please talk about the trap we feel we are getting rushed into headlong, into a war against terrorism, where those like Ariel Sharon have co-opted this "we are fighting terrorists" rhetoric for an ethnic cleansing purpose. And we have no recourse left but to criticize them, that is Sharon and the Israelis, but due to our own actions, that is the United States. Muriel, do you want to take that?
Well, I don't really understand the question, that we have nothing to, no recourse but to criticize.
That's what he's concerned with. I think the underlying issue in this question could be what you've heard from the Anti-Defamation League and those things, that if you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic, I guess.
Yes. Well, I'm speaking, of course, here from Germany, and this argument has been made here in a very, very vicious way, literally squashing any debate, silencing any political figure who dares to criticize Israeli current policy on the grounds, alleged grounds, that this is anti-Semitic. It's totally nonsense. And I think it's a ruse. It's a fraud. It's something that is being deliberately used by the pro-Sharon, pro-war faction in order to prevent any debate from taking place about what they are doing. And, you know, if, for example, there was a news here in Germany just a couple of weeks ago that the World Jewish Congress had opened up a new operation, a new institution in Europe with branches in many European countries, and the explicit purpose of this new office is to make pressure on political figures and particularly to influence the mass media in this sense. And in the founding papers of this new institution, they say very explicitly, we have to make it clear that any criticism of the Sharon government or the Israeli government, Israeli military policy, is a form of anti-Semitism, and therefore it has to be attacked and it has to be smashed. So these things happen. Now, does that mean people should be quiet? No, quite the contrary. And I want to point to the fact that inside Israel today, there are hundreds of reserve military troops, as well, including officers, who have had the courage to stand up and say precisely what others have said and been attacked for as anti-Semitic. So there are people inside Israel actually spending time in prison because they've had the courage to stand up and say, I will not take part as a military representative of, as a member of the army, I will not take part in operations against the Palestinian population, which I consider to be ethnic cleansing. And inside Israel itself, opposition figures have come out and said what Lyndon LaRouche was the first to say, that what the Israelis are doing right now against the population of the Palestinians can only be compared to what the Nazis did against the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. So, truth is, I think, the strongest, the most powerful weapon in this kind of situation, and people emphatically inside the United States have to have the courage to stand up and tell the truth. And in that way, to mobilize a resistance against what Sharon is doing, against the support that the current administration has been giving to this ethnic cleansing led by Sharon, and of course to prevent the next step towards a war against Iraq.
Well, I think the best way that people can form that resistance is to participate in this 5 million leaflet campaign, which is very, very urgent. I'd like to go to our organizing conference call. Are there any questions from the conference call?
We need to ask Muriel a question. I think people would like to know, what is the reaction in Europe and also from Iran and the Middle East on LaRouche's initiative to go after Senators McCain and Lieberman?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because, you know, when LaRouche first launched this campaign, many of us here asked ourselves, how can we get this across to a non-American audience? We asked ourselves in editorial meetings, how can we present this so that people in Europe and elsewhere will understand? And we found that there was absolutely no difficulty whatsoever for people in Europe, also in the Arab Islamic world, to understand what this is all about. Why? Maybe they didn't know about McCain and his background. Maybe they didn't know about Lieberman. But they had the idea, of course, that Lieberman was a liberal Democrat and somebody who, you know, was a prominent force in the Democratic Party. They know, of course, that he's pushing for war, but they had no understanding of the forces behind these two figures, and they had no understanding of the function of the McCain-Lieberman combination in influencing the current policies of the administration right now. So once we got across to them this idea that, yes, you have people in the and around the administration, you have Armitage, you have Pearl, you have Wolfowitz, you have the warmongers who are pushing for the war, but if you had an effective opposition, the situation would be different. Instead, what should be the opposition, the Democratic Party, is being manipulated by this combination with the Republican McCain, and is calling for war even more loudly than the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, and the others. So what you have to do is to destabilize this combination, destabilize it by revealing its political roots, that it's a mafia, organized crime, extreme right-wing Zionist lobby combination. You destabilize that, and in that way you can shake up the combination, reshuffle the chairs, as LaRouche put it, in Washington, and actually influence sane people inside the Republican Party and around the administration who might be able to force policy thinking into a different direction. The thing that is most appealing to people in Europe and also among Arabs that I've talked to about this is the idea. It gives them hope. In other words, up until the time that LaRouche launched this intervention, people were saying, we don't want the war, but we can't do anything about it. We don't want the war. We can raise our voices in Europe, among the Arab world, etc. We can issue our support for LaRouche, which is what the Arabs are doing in large part, also in Iran. But we can't influence what's happening in Washington, and the only way that the war is going to be prevented is through an intervention that changes policy in Washington. So here, with this intervention, LaRouche has said, I am going to destroy this power combination. I'm going to shake up the entire arrangement, and in that way create a situation in which I can change policy direction of the current administration. And people are very, very optimistic about this. We've had this response from people in Britain, from people in Germany, and from recent visitors that we had here from Egypt and elsewhere who are extremely excited about it. And I think now these various reports and background dossiers that we're putting out in EIR and through the leaflet. These things are now going out throughout Europe, through our publications in Europe, and also through publications in the Arab and Islamic world.
Well, is there another question from the conference line? This is a very, very crucial exchange to getting at the heart of how are we going to break the tyranny of this mafia of lies and get Mr. LaRouche in the White House sooner rather than later.
There's something that I would like to add.
Go ahead, Amelia.
You know, in talking with a number of people in the United Nations and people from other countries, they're all against what Bush is planning on doing. But they're sitting on the sideline doing nothing, turning their heads and looking the other way. And my suggestion to them, especially those people in the United Nations, is for them to get together, if they possibly can, if not singly, that they can contact Bush and let them know that we are not in accord with your going into Iraq or what you're doing in pushing up Sharon, which is we are, because of the fact that they're going to start a war, a fire that they can't put out.
Yes.
But what they can do, they can register their feelings toward it, what's going on. And if these other countries were to say that that's criminal, that we don't go along with you, don't you know if the whole world were to get on Bush, he would back down? And that's what they need to do. They need to have the courage, the other countries, to speak out against what's going on. And they certainly can do a lot by speaking out against it. And one of the representatives said to me, well, you know, we are tied up with IMF and with the World Bank, and they are afraid to speak up against. But if all of them do, then the IMF and World Bank and the rest of them can't pressure the whole world. So this is one thing that they can do. And speaking about terrorism, my gosh, we have terrorism everywhere. And there is, when I think of terrorism and what's going on now in Afghanistan, it's the same identical thing that Herod did when he was looking for the Christ child and even told the three wise men, let me know where he is that I might come and worship him. But he feared that his kingdom would be set asunder. And what did he do? He had every boy child killed from 2 years on down. When we went into Afghanistan, we went there and killed everything that was in sight. We had no respect for babies, children, adults, or anywhere else. And that inflated Bush and the administration. And as they say, the next will be Iraq, then Iran, and then North Korea, and the rest of them, and the whole world is going to stand up and let that happen? Shame on the world.
Amelia, I have another question to follow up on what you were saying earlier about the fight for the Voting Rights Act and the fight for Lyndon LaRouche's election campaign back in 2000. It's the following. I had the recent discussion, again, reflecting the vicious lies that are coming from the Anti-Defamation League and such opponents of Mr. LaRouche and world peace, where someone who is very, very active in fighting for the rights of Palestinians to get food and so forth said, I will not work with Mr. LaRouche because I have read that he is a racist.
That's
and I'd like you to comment on that.
That's very unfortunate. But that is the way that this country has been all of the time, and these organizations that are afraid, it is dividing and conquering.
Right.
That's the main thing. That's the nucleus of the whole thing, to get people afraid, to divide. They divided African Americans, they divided the Indians, made them fight against each other, and they tried to divide people in the 60s, but the main reason why they do it is to conquer, and that's the reason why the ADL, like Christian organizations that are just as unchristian-like as can be, they use that in order that they might go along. And if you were to talk to the heads, you'll find out that terrible thing, fear. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who said that the greatest fear in the world is fear itself. And they are afraid. They're afraid of pressure being placed on them.
Absolutely. Thank you. Muriel, I have several questions that have come in by email about 911 and terrorism. I'm going to combine them to basically address the question, what really happened? This one question from Tim in Central Coast, California. Zacharias Moussaoui claims he wants to put forth evidence that implicates individuals within the U.S. government in the World Trade disaster. Another says, are you saying it may have actually been Americans who hijacked the planes? What does Mr. LaRouche mean about an internal coup d'etat?
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. I mean, I think anybody who wants to research this question should actually call in to the number that you gave before and request a copy of the report that was put out by the LaRouche campaign called Zbigniew Brzezinski and September 11th.
Let me give that number now in case people have time. It's 1-888-347-3258.
Because that report gives the most exhaustive analysis and background documentation to LaRouche's thesis, which I think everybody knows he put out that very day as the events were unfolding. He had no evidence, he had no facts, just the reports of what was happening. But what he said very clearly then, and what we've substantiated and documented since, is the following. The nature of the attacks against the World Trade Center in New York first, and particularly against the Pentagon after that in Washington, show a level of organization, planning, logistical capability, which no known so-called terrorist group, be it Al-Qaeda or anything else, has ever demonstrated ever before. Now, the crucial thing to take into consideration is that the fact that the security apparatuses, the security measures, which should have been in place in order to move against these airplanes once it was clear that one had hit the World Trade Center, another was about to hit the other tower. The security arrangements, which should have been in place in order to intercept further planes, and particularly to protect the Pentagon, which has its own security measures, these security arrangements failed. And either they failed because of internal disintegration, which in itself would be a major national security emergency for the United States, or more likely, they were manipulated, they were neutralized so that these attacks could take place. There is no organization of terrorists throughout the world who have the ability to intervene at that level in order to neutralize these security capabilities. That means that there must have been complicity and participation at a very high level inside the United States of the rogue elements. These are not the traditional patriotic forces, but rogue elements inside the United States military and security institutions in order to make these attacks possible. and also to prepare the cover-up, of course. So now this has been substantiated by many people, by military experts, for example, General Khalaf, who is a leading military expert in Egypt, who presented his view of this, and many, many others have now since substantiated it. But the point to understand is this was an attack against the institution of the United States government, the constitutional and elected government. It was an attack aimed at unleashing a policy of permanent war against the Islamic world, a clash of civilizations. And we've seen since September 11th, unfortunately, that the forces behind this attempted coup d'etat have succeeded in putting this policy on the agenda and pursuing it, first with the war against Afghanistan and now with their planned war against Iraq. So that shows you also what the nature of the entity is that was behind this. Mr. LaRouche has pointed out also that the attacks against the World Trade Center first, instead of focusing on the Pentagon first, which of course would have been the strategic target for a military coup d'etat, but that they focused on the World Trade Center towers first in order to create the shock for the American population, which would be used then to mobilize popular support for the kind of war against terrorism that we've seen unfold. But I just recommend to everyone to read through that report and compare it with the press accounts of the cover story, which is Bin Laden did it, Mohammed Atta, and so on and so forth, and ask yourselves in reading these press reports of the cover story, where is the evidence? There's never been any evidence provided by the government or any other investigating agency to substantiate the cover story, whereas all the evidence leads in the direction of substantiating the hypothesis put out first by LaRouche.
We're almost out of time. You can reach the LaRouche Movement at 1-888-347-3258. We've been speaking with Amelia Boynton Robinson and Muriel Mirak-Weisbach, two leaders of the LaRouche Movement, on the Middle East war danger and how the LaRouche Movement's mobilization can stop this catastrophe. This is Michelle Steinberg. Thank you.